Everybody, it's Kai Rizdahl. Thanks once again for listening to the Corner Office Podcast. This time we are talking about real estate and tech and media, kinda. Spencer Raskoff is the guest. He's the CEO of Zillow. He's been at the company since basically the beginning, one of the founders, really. We're talking about Zillow deciding to start buying and selling homes on their own and housing throughout the financial crisis as well. Also, a broader conversation about where housing in this economy is today.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Spencer Raskoff, good to have you in the studio.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What does your company do?
We are Zillow Group, so we operate a collection of real estate websites. The largest is Zillow. About 180 million people come to our websites every month to get information about real estate, and they shop for homes, they look for rentals, they do all sorts of things related to real estate.
You have said in an interview I read before coming in here, you've said that this is a real estate media company. What does that mean?
It is. So what it means is that we have all this incredible information. It empowers consumers, and then we make money by selling ads. So we'll do about $1.5 billion of revenue this year, and it's advertising driven. So we sell advertising to real estate agents, mortgage lenders, property managers of rentals. So it's a media company.
So when I go and check out the Zestimate on my house, just to give you the branding there.
Thank you.
Which I do not infrequently, I will tell you, which kind of surprises me. You're selling ads against my clickage, I suppose, right?
We are, yeah. The biggest part of our advertising revenue, almost $1 billion, comes from real estate agents that appear on active listings. So when you're looking at a home for sale, you'll see a couple buyer's agents next to that listing, and those are agents that are paying us to show up there and try to help you buy that house.
You've been at this company for a long time, shall we say.
Yeah,
like,
I helped
like
start
13
it.
Years, right? So you started it up.
Yeah, exactly.
When you started it up, when you helped start it up, rather, to give credit to the co-founders, what was the plan?
it's I laugh because the plan initially was empower consumers with access to information, set all this data free, but there wasn't much of a business plan associated with it. We had the attitude that in this category of real estate, if you can aggregate a large enough audience, surely there will be some revenue opportunity available to us later.
if you build it, they will come?
Yeah, pretty much. Like a lot of media-based startups, actually. And so the idea was aggregate an audience. And we launched with the Zestimate 12 years ago. People came to figure out what their house was worth. And it wasn't until almost 5 years later that we really happened upon a serious business model.
On the other side of the housing crash, we should point out, which we'll get to in a minute.
Yes.
Here's the thing, though, about data and information and buying a home. Sure, yes, you want the data and you want to know what mortgage rates are and you want to know how close the schools are and you want to know what prior sales prices are. But there's an incredibly emotional aspect to buying a house. How do you put that into the algorithm?
Well, we've tried to infuse it into the brand. That's actually what Zillow means. Zillow is zillions of pillows. It's the data,
really?
The left brain, the left brain aspect of real estate. And pillow is the squishy, emotional, you know, where you rest your head at night side. So it comes through in the brand and the advertising and the brand positioning. In terms of into the product, the emotional side of home values doesn't factor into the Zestimate. I mean, the Zestimate is very much a mathematical algorithm that tries to figure out what every house is worth.
Where do you get that data, by the way, this estimate data? Because I will tell you, on my house, it's not right. I'm just saying, it's not right.
Sorry about
that. It's too low.
Of course. I never hear that. So the property attributes, bed, bath, square footage, tax assessment, that ultimately comes from county records, which we get directly from counties. Listing information we get from brokerages and multiple listing services. And then we get lots of other data from other sources, county records, crime data, school data, et cetera. And then the Zestimate is something that we produce on top of all that.
You know, it occurs to me, you say you're a real estate media company. Really, you're a data company. Right?
We are. Absolutely. Like most internet companies, actually, at their core.
Yeah. And you know things about my home and my home prices because of that data. Like there's some Trader Joe's corollary and a Whole Foods corollary. I mean, it's kind of crazy.
Yes. The reference you're making about Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, I wrote a book on this called Zillow Talk, which talks all about...
Get it? Zillow Talk, Zillion.
Thank you.
Zillow.
Yeah, there you go. we're clever that way. Yeah. All about, what you can find in the data.
Do we need this in the housing market in this country today?
I think so. Prior to Zillow, the consumer was disempowered. I mean, it was there was massive information asymmetry. Practitioners, real estate agents, real estate professionals had this information, and consumers did not. So like so many other things that the internet has done, it has leveled the playing field in terms of information access. And I think that's very important.
I want to talk about the housing market in this country in a second. But first, I want to take you back to not long after you guys started. You were 2.5-ish something years old. And then the housing market in this country goes kerflooey.
Yeah.
And not only is it bad for the housing market and the economy, it's bad for you as a company.
It was. Yeah, 2008 was very difficult for us as a company. We had layoffs. We went from about 200 employees to about 150. We really had to buckle down and try to make it through. And it wasn't clear whether we would survive or not as a company.
As you did the postmortem after the financial crisis and the housing crash, was there stuff in your data that made you say, oh, man, we should have seen this coming?
There was, and we did see it coming, and we made it clear, actually. So I wrote blog posts in 2007. You can still find them on Google. I wrote one called The Tidal Wave is Coming, where I and then our chief economist wrote similar posts. We were looking at the data, the delinquency data, and you could see
in the loans,
you could absolutely see that people were overextended on the credit. They were starting to miss interest payments, and it was obvious that there was going to be a mortgage crisis a year or two later. Now, I wish that you
had done something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. First of all, I mean, a lot of people made a lot of money with that foresight. We probably got overextended on our own headcount. You know, getting up to about 200 employees. Was probably a little aggressive, and we perhaps should have hired more slowly going into that downturn. But we did position the business well enough that we didn't do a down round, meaning we didn't raise money from investors at a lower valuation. My prior company, Hotwire, which I started in 1999, went through the September 11th, 2001 crisis and had similar challenges to Zillow's in 2008. Because of 9/11 in 2001, we also laid off from about 200 to 150 because we were an online travel company through a travel recession. Right. Now, we did a down round. We had to raise money in order to survive at a much lower valuation, and that wiped out a lot of the equity of our early investors and employees. Of course, we couldn't have seen 9/11 coming the way we could see the housing crisis coming at Zillow in 2008. So we positioned the company as best we could going into the recession in 2008, and we made it through.
Yeah, so well enough, I guess, is how you position it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you, as you look now at housing in this country and the data that you have, actually, what do you make of the housing market?
It's hot. It is red hot. We're now past peak value in almost every city in the country. So that means we're above the 2007 peak that everyone talked about as a bubble. Home values are up 9% year over year. The difference, though, today versus 2007 is 2007, the housing bubble was really built on a foundation of sand. And the foundation of sand was easy credit. About 10 million people got mortgages through the 2000s that really should never have gotten mortgages because it was so easy to get one. Today, what's driven home price appreciation is lack of inventory.
Yeah.
So there are 9% fewer homes available for sale today than a year ago. So just lack of inventory is why home values have gone up so much. And that's a more fundamentally sound housing recovery.
But it does point to a social problem in this country,
Absolutely.
Which is not enough affordable housing, right?
A huge problem. And I mean, you see it in every city in the country. And it's a huge problem. There's no easy solution to it.
Yeah.
I mean, we need more houses. So one of the reasons why there's not enough inventory is through the recession, 2008 through 2011, there were hundreds of thousands of homes that were not built. So just to give you some data, going into the last housing upturn, there were about 1 million homes built a year. And then through the recession, there were about 200,000 homes built a year for several years. So we're literally missing a couple million homes in the housing stock. Now, here we are almost 10 years later, and a couple million homes missing means just too much demand, not enough supply. Home values appreciate really quickly.
Do you impute any fragility in the red hotness of the housing market then?
No. I mean, the super high end has slowed down a little bit as there are fewer foreign buyers than there used to be 2 or 3 years ago. But the mid-level is still incredibly hot, especially the lower price tiers are very, very hot because home builders have basically given up on building entry-level homes. So the $200,000-$400,000 home, the new home just really doesn't exist anymore because labor's expensive, land's expensive. So home builders, when they build homes, they build more expensive homes. So there's very limited inventory at the low end.
A word here about the growth of this company, which has been sort of exceptional, really, when you think about it. You've done it mostly by acquisitions. Why is that the strategy?
We have acquired a lot of companies, I think 17 by last count. We have 8 different consumer brands. So we acquired Trulia, which was a leading real estate site, Street Easy in New York, mm-hmm. HotPaz, which is a rental site. The reason we have so many different brands is that we think in a category like this, which is so considered so important, people are going to go to multiple brands. They're going to check out Zillow, they're going to check out Trulia, they're going to check out realestate.com. And each of these brands have slightly different features, slightly different positionings, slightly different value proposition to the user. So that's one of the reasons we've been very acquisitive. The other category of acquisitions that we've done have been software tools for real estate professionals. So these are companies like Dotloop, for example, which does transaction management. It lets a real estate agent help a consumer buy a house on their phone. It helps the agent and the consumer and the mortgage lender keep each other in the loop on what's happening in the transaction. And so software tools like Dotloop and others that we've acquired really improve the efficiency of real estate agents and consumers.
And you guys are actually getting into the business of buying and selling yourselves.
We are. This is big news. Yeah. So just a couple weeks ago, we started buying and selling houses in Phoenix and Las Vegas, and later this year in other cities too.
How come? It seems a hair off the core competency.
It can seem that way at first. We look at it a little differently. As you point out, we're a data company, right? So what we have that no one else has is we have information on what houses people want to buy. And so we think that offering this service to the seller will allow us to match supply and demand between seller and buyer. So imagine a seller in this on-demand economy. Think about what you do on your smartphone. You press a button and magic happens. You press a button, the car arrives. You press a button, the food arrives. You press a button, you know, Amazon brings you things. Consumers want that type of convenience and ease. And so for the seller, we're trying to provide that convenience and ease where they take an all-cash offer without having to ready their home for sale.
In an economy where consumers are have a great tendency to do things perhaps without thinking, and I say this without aspersion to American consumers, do we want them doing transactions this size on their phones?
Yes, I think so. I think so.
Yes, because that's your business. I think so. But come on, man.
Well, there's still a lot of consideration in the transaction, obviously. But I mean, the phone is the computer. That is the new computer. People are buying engagement rings on their phone. They're planning vacations on their phone, and that is it's a computer now. I mean, you're not going to see people accidentally buying or selling their home the way you might accidentally download an app from the App Store.
You say that, but there's no small amount of what could possibly go wrong here on this.
There is regulation as well around even, for example, mortgage origination, which has a bit of a waiting period. Yeah. It's about 10 days to even close a mortgage. So there's some intentional speed bumps there. But I think the idea of it is just way too complicated for most people to sell their home. And so the trade-in model of a car, I think, has applicability for homes. Right. So we find that these sellers are intimidated by the sale process. They don't want to declutter the garage. They don't want to have to make the necessary repairs to ready the home for sale. And if somebody will make an all-cash offer within spitting distance of what fair value of the home is, then they can focus on the exciting part of the home transaction, which is buying the next home. For most people, lining up the sale of their home with the purchase of the next home is almost impossible, and it's a requirement for them to buy the next home. So we look at our service as basically providing liquidity to the seller so they can have an all-cash offer in hand for their existing home and then go buy their next home.
With all that you do, now buying and selling homes, but also truly in all your consumer brands, who's your competition? Who do you worry about?
Well, we always have competition. So, I mean, the biggest competition is sort of traditional inertia. So the way still most homes are bought and sold is by people driving around, looking at yard signs, knocking on doors, going to open houses, et cetera, not really utilizing the internet. So that's the biggest competition, is just getting people to use the web to search for homes. From a revenue model standpoint, the biggest competition is probably still newspaper advertising, where there's still billions and billions of dollars spent on newspaper classifieds advertising homes for sale and real estate agents. And we think that most of that budget eventually moves on to the internet, but it takes a long time for those shifts to happen.
You're not concerned about a company like Redfin, which actually has real estate brokers and all that? You're banking on the internet and online.
Well, we definitely compete with companies like that for consumer audience. Someone might use their website, they might use our website, they might use both. But we have very different business models. I mean, Redfin is a brokerage that makes money in the transaction. When somebody buys or sells homes, they earn a commission. So they compete with companies like Corcoran, Douglas Elliman, the agency, Century 21, Remax, and traditional brokerages. Those are all partners of ours. We're a media company, and we connect consumers with professionals of all brokerages. We don't work for a single brokerage.
What keeps you up at night other than, well, no, what keeps you up at night? Let me not answer the question for you.
Lots. We're in our second decade. Most tech companies fail when they first start. Right. But those that succeed and reach scale and get public and kind of get to our stage, usually they have a mediocre second decade and then kind of a lame third decade and they wither into irrelevance. The reason for that, I think, and I'm constantly asking myself, why is that? But I believe that the reason for that is that when companies get to our size, over $1 billion of revenue, 4,000 employees, et cetera, people start protecting the core rather than trying to disrupt themselves and innovate. And that's what I'm focused on. I'm trying to make sure that we're still taking risks. We're still pushing the envelope. We're not resting on our laurels. That's what I worry about, more so than competition or anything exogenous.
Sort of following on to that question, the idea of you as the CEO of this company now for 8-ish something years, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're a young guy, and you've been at this company forever. Why of the three co-founders are you the one running the company?
Well, I it's true. This is the longest I've ever been in any company. We started 13 years ago.
So,
and I'm having fun. I mean, I assume that's why you're still there.
Also true, yeah.
So I'm having fun. I love the people I work with. I feel like we have a lot left to accomplish. When we started the company, I was not the CEO. I was the CMO and then the COO and kind of had a number of executive positions. And I became CEO about 8 or so years ago. Our co-founder and the first CEO is our executive chairman, still very, very involved in the company and a terrific mentor to me. And so he's very involved too. But I'm the CEO and I'm having a great time.
Yeah, let's get to the gist of the question though. How do you think about being a CEO, right? Why did those, of the three, why is it you?
I think I'm a good communicator and a good leader of people. I think that the role of the CEO is to solve problems for his or her directs. It's to make everybody beneath them more efficient and effective. And I really focus on that and prioritize that. I don't believe it's to boss people around. I don't believe it's to tell people what to do. We have all these incredible, competent, highly qualified people. They actually know what to do. Mm. They need to be motivated and they need to have their roadblocks cleared. And so we practice at Zillow Group this servant leadership concept where the role of the manager is to empower the people beneath them rather than the other way around. And I'm pretty good at that.
Spencer Raskoff at Zillow. Spencer, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for my conversation with Spencer Raskoff about Zillow and what it does. Thanks for listening. If you thought the conversation was interesting, if you learned something, let us know. You can rate us on Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review there as well. Maybe share it with a friend. Do something, please. Corner Office Podcast is produced by Bridget Bonder. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Star Nieves is the Executive Director of On Demand. Deborah Clark is the Senior Vice President and General Manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Another episode in a couple of weeks.